This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in progress.
Today on the program, little progress for developing countries at the Durban Climate Conference.
Even if we have a quite good deal here in Durban, and that would mean a second commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol, it's still not enough, and this would be catastrophic for many developing countries.
The Red Cross calls for greater protection of medical personnel in conflict zones.
Wounded people, sick people should have the right to be treated and to reach hospitals and clinics anytime.
And residential developments threaten wildlife park near Nairobi.
There's no reason why people can't live with wildlife. It's actually very possible. The local form of pastoralism is not threatening wildlife at all. And in fact, the Maasai lifestyle is very much in tune with nature.
Welcome to World in Progress. I'm Anke Raspar in Bonn. The Durban Conference on Climate Change is in its second week now, and environment ministers and delegations from all over the world are negotiating a follow-up agreement to the Kyoto Protocol. While most of the major polluters, like the United States, but also emerging economies like China, don't want binding agreements, developing nations who suffer most from climate change but pollute the least feel they are not being heard. My colleague Johannes Beck is at the Durban conference this week. I caught up with him before the show.
From what I've read, it appears like at the Durban meeting, there has been a widening gap opening up between the interests of poorer developing countries and those emerging economies like India and China as far as their climate policies are concerned. Would you say this perception is correct?
Yeah, I think so, especially when we are talking about the small island states like the Maldives, Tuvalu and other countries that are quite vulnerable. Because if the average temperature will increase by more than 2 degrees, or in some places even 1 degree would be enough, those countries will just disappear. Other countries will face big, big challenges, floodings, for example, of losing coastal areas like in Bangladesh. And these countries are not the countries that are emitting a large part of the greenhouse gases. So if you take India, for example, or China, those are two countries who are actually emitting more and more greenhouse gases. Especially China is already having a per capita level equal to some member states of the European Union. And the Chinese say that they need more economic growth and more emissions.
You couldn't say there's any kind of solidarity between those rich emerging economies and the poorer developing countries.
Well, they talk about solidarity, and actually in one big negotiating group, the G77 and China, but the interests are too different to have one common stance here in Durban. And I believe that actually the Chinese are probably a bit more flexible. Also, Brazil has shown a great interest in continuing here with the negotiations and in achieving a big deal, which definitely will help. But especially India is really blocking any further commitments, at least until now. They say that they want the European countries and other countries that have emission targets under the Kyoto Protocol to continue, but they're refusing new targets for developing countries.
And are other developing nations discussing this with China and saying, well, it's not enough if you accept other people's commitment, you also have to curb CO2 emissions from China?
Well, there has been a lot of talking about China in the last days here in Durban, especially after the first appearance of the Chinese Minister for Environment. He seemed to be more flexible. He said that China is willing to accept a new legally binding agreement, and they are going to accept steps that would lead to such an agreement that's probably not going to be finished until 2015. That's definitely some kind of improvement if you compare it to Copenhagen 2 years ago, where China blocked almost all initiatives to get such a new agreement. But they had a large number of conditions, and we actually do not know exactly what the Chinese mean by legally binding, because in one interpretation, that would mean that China would also accept legally binding targets for China as well. And in the other interpretation, it would mean that China would accept other countries to make a deal with legally binding agreements for them. And this has not been clarified yet here in Durban.
Now, one of the things they want to achieve or would like to achieve this year is, of course, really setting up the rules for something that was proposed last year, namely a green climate fund to help the developing countries adapt to climate change. How likely do you think is it that at this Durban conference they will really finalize the rules and regulations to set up this fund?
I think this is going to happen here in Durban. If we are going to see something or some improvement, it's probably the green climate fund. I'm not quite sure if we are actually have to have here 100% of the regulations in place after Durban, but probably there's going to be an agreement about the architecture of this fund. If this conference is going to fail completely regarding emission cuts, probably there's going to be a problem with the Green Climate Fund as well. But if we're going to have a minimal agreement here on reducing emissions or continuing with a second commitment period under the Kyoto Protocol, there's probably to be an outcome as well for climate financing.
How optimistic are you that the developing countries will be in a better position after Durban?
Well, I'm not very optimistic. Even if we have a quite good deal here in Durban, and that would mean a second commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol and an agreement about how to achieve a major climate deal with the emerging countries and all the developed countries as well until 2015, it's still not enough to reduce global warming to 2 degrees or even less. We had very, very alarming signals the last years and the last months and days before Durban. And it's definitely now that we have to act, because if it's not now, the atmosphere will definitely have too much CO2 in the next years to limit global warming to 2 degrees. So emissions will have to peak in the next years, and it's not possible, like India has proposed, to start talking about a global agreement beginning in 2020, because this will be too late. So if we're not going to act now, we are heading to a world with 6, 5, or 4 degrees more than during the pre-industrial age, and this would be catastrophic for many developing countries.
That was Johannes Beck talking from the Durban Climate Conference. For more in-depth information from the Climate Summit, go to our special webpage at dw-world.de/climate. Security and lack of services for civilians remain pressing issues for the Afghan population. The conflict in Afghanistan also continues to endanger medical staff and hospitals. That is also the case in many other conflict regions around the world, where humanitarian aid workers and ambulances and also patients are frequently becoming targets of war and armed conflicts. The International Red Cross, which was once formed as a neutral organization to help all victims of conflict, has recently started a campaign for greater security for hospitals and health personnel in war zones. The Red Cross demands more protection for aid workers, hospitals and patients in conflict zones such as Afghanistan. This report by Claudia Witte is presented by Brendan O'Shea.
18-year-old Hasti Khan is lucky to be alive. As he was enjoying the celebrations at a wedding in Helmand province in southern Afghanistan, his village was bombed and Hasti was severely injured. Covered in burns and grenade shrapnel in his stomach, he and his brother Abdul had to wait until early the next morning before they were able to make their way to a hospital. They couldn't find an ambulance, and several taxi drivers refused to take them. After having taken a number of detours, they finally reached the Miwaris Hospital in Kandahar. By that time, Hasti was unconscious, as his brother Abdul recalls.
There are landmines hidden everywhere, and roads are unpassable. It is so difficult. Unless you're badly injured or near death, you will not take this route.
But Hasti is no exception, says Bian Fanoudi at the International Committee of the Red Cross in Geneva.
In Orten wie Afghanistan, wo ich die letzten zwei Jahre stationiert war.
In places like Afghanistan, where I was stationed for the last 2 years, we saw mothers with children reach hospitals daily. They suffered from simple diseases that could have been treated very easily, but many of them died because these women simply don't dare to leave their home to go to hospital in time.
In conflict zones across the world, the roads to hospitals tend to be blocked by checkpoints at which armed men arbitrarily decide who is allowed to pass. According to Alberto Caro, who heads the ICRC's orthopaedic program in Afghanistan, in many cases, even medical staff are denied permission to pass.
Suddenly, the commander of a certain area is not the commander of before, who knew us, and now it's dangerous to go. You don't know the person that you have to deal with, so because of them, we don't go ourselves, expatriate, but also the Afghan, our team, cannot move, it's too dangerous.
But Afghanistan is only one example of what is a more widespread problem. In conflict zones around the world, lack of security restricts people's access to health services, just when they need them most. Countless people are dying because the roads to the nearest hospital is unsafe, even life-threatening. Hospitals can come under fire and medical personnel and ambulances are attacked. In an attempt to document the extent of the problem, the International Committee of the Red Cross has registered and analysed incidents in 16 countries in which it is active. The results have shocked even experienced humanitarian aid workers, says ICRC Director Pierre Créanboul.
We've discovered that attacks by gangs and acts of violence take place frequently. What is even more appalling is that in many cases, people don't actually die in the attacks themselves, but because of the delay in getting first aid to them or transporting them to the hospital.
These attacks have a knock-on effect, with millions of people ending up being at risk because of the attacks on health services. The ICRC says this represents one of the biggest humanitarian challenges of our times, but one that gets the least recognition. Most incidents happen without the greater public ever learning the details. The International Committee of the Red Cross has now initiated a worldwide campaign aimed at getting the issue on the international agenda. It wants all stakeholders in conflict zones to urgently come together to find a solution. Red Cross spokesman Bian Van Nudi says there are many possible ways to improve the circumstances.
For
example, countries need to ensure that armed forces are trained adequately and know how to behave before they are sent on missions, so that they are prepared for these types of emergencies at checkpoints and that they know how to react appropriately.
The message for governments, armies and rebel forces is clear, that they should respect the neutrality of medical personnel and guarantee the right to medical attention for civilians caught up in the fighting under all circumstances. The ICRC's Alberto Caro says even if attacks on medical staff and their patients are widespread, there is no need for the situation to stay that way.
Wounded people, sick people should have the right to be treated and to reach hospitals and clinics any time something has to be done. We cannot be just content in saying that there is nothing to do, we have to accept it. No, something has to be done and can be done.
For Radio Deutsche Welle, this is Brendan O'Shea.
You're listening to World in Progress, and you can find more development content online at dw.de/development. Still to come on today's show, a report about a wildlife park in Kenya that's threatened by illegal settlements. But first, Jesse Wingard takes a quick glance at some development news.
First testimony in Bangladesh war crimes trial. In Bangladesh, the first trial of a suspected collaborator from Bangladesh's 1971 War of Independence is underway. The accused, Delaware Hussein Saidi, now a senior politician, was accused by a witness on Wednesday of identifying the homes of supporters of the Bangladesh Liberation Movement, which led to a wave of looting and arson by pro-Pakistan militia. Saidi stands charged with crimes against humanity, genocide, murder, rape, religious persecution and enslavement. False perceptions underpin anti-migrant sentiments. The rising tide of anti-migrant sentiment worldwide is caused primarily by biased, polarised and negative debate on migration, according to a new study released by the International Organisation for Migration, IOM, this week. The report said people in destination countries tend to significantly overestimate the size of the migrant population, sometimes by as much as 300%. Most governments and business enterprises tend to be favourably disposed to immigration, while the general public remains reluctant to admit foreigners. China to target emerging countries as exports slip. China will seek to boost exports to emerging economies next year in the face of severe challenges caused by downturns in Europe and the United States, a senior official said Wednesday. To cushion the impact on exports, Beijing will target developing countries that are growing strongly, says Wang Shuwen, director of the Commerce Ministry's Foreign Trade Department. Wang did not name specific countries but said Latin America and the Asian region would grow next year and have demand for Chinese exports.
That was Jesse Wingard with the development news. In Brazil, attitudes and policies towards HIV and AIDS have changed a lot in the last two decades. Today, some 97% of all persons in the country living with HIV are getting access to antiretroviral drugs. Half of the drugs are produced by Brazil itself. The country spends more than R1 billion, that's 480 million euros, to fight HIV and AIDS. Thanks to improved education programs, medical care and the promotion of condoms, the portion of Brazil's population affected by HIV or AIDS is stagnating at 0.6%. That is why Brazil has become a role model on how to deal with the pandemic. A report by Mariana Santos, presented by Laura Schweiger.
I was in my late 20s and in a productive phase in my life and had to worry about death.
Aguinaldo José Gomes, a former gym teacher, found out he was HIV positive 22 years ago. Since then, he takes a drug cocktail every day that protects his body against the disease. At 51 years old, Gomes is now a well-known AIDS activist in Brazil. Some things have changed in Brazil's health system over the past two decades when it comes to treating people who are HIV positive. UNAIDS, the United Nations Program for HIV and AIDS, has named Brazil a model country in the fight against AIDS. Each year, the country invests some 480 million euros to combat the disease through testing, awareness campaigns, the distribution of condoms, the supply of medication, and treatment of people who are HIV positive.
UNAIDS has concluded that Brazil has a strategic model that is rather well suited to the reality of the country. This is because the model is designed to optimize the use of resources and concentrates on the part of the population which is most vulnerable.
That's Pedro Schaquer, head of UNAIDS in Brazil. A key part of the Brazilian HIV/AIDS program is the general free access to HIV drugs. Brazil was one of the first countries to distribute the medications required to fight the virus free of charge. Costs for the drugs will reach about 847 million reais this year. That's some 350 million euros. According to Dirceu Greco from the Brazilian Ministry of Health, 215,000, that's 97% of Brazilians who have been diagnosed with HIV, receive the 20 drugs that Brazil currently uses to treat the disease. 10 of these medications are produced in the country. But as Greco explains, this statistic doesn't completely reflect the reality of the situation.
It's estimated that between 200,000 and 230,000 people in Brazil don't know that they are HIV positive because they haven't been tested. If we included these people in our calculations, then the portion of people being treated would fall from 97% to a rate between 60 and 79%.
Pedro Schaquer from UNAIDS emphasizes that there are a few gaps in the Brazilian program that must be closed. He points to regional differences when it comes to accessing information.
Many regions in the north and northeast of Brazil still don't have access to rapid testing, treatment for the disease, or the most effective prevention measures.
The Brazilian Ministry of Health says its primary goal in 2012 is to increase the rate of early HIV recognition. To achieve this, the country plans to increase the number of locations at which rapid testing is conducted, where a result is given within 30 minutes. Pedro Schaquer applauds this initiative.
The biggest challenge for Brazil now is to expand access to testing, so that by 2015, more than 80% of all people infected can be treated. This goal has already been achieved in countries like Botswana, Chile, or Cuba.
Testing will be offered in public places and especially promoted during events like Carnival, Gay Pride Parades, and World AIDS Day. The Ministry of Health is also planning to offer free tests to fans during the 2014 World Cup Soccer Championships in Brazil. Brazil has established various partnerships with countries in Latin America and Africa to exchange information about treatment and HIV prevention. The partnership with Mozambique has led to the Brazilian government's decision to approve the technology transfer for the construction of an antiretroviral medications factory in Maputo. Dirceu Greco from Brazil's Ministry of Health explains.
It's a give and take setup. We will learn from them how to handle situations that are more complex than ours.
Although Brazil's HIV/AIDS program is viewed as an international model, there is nonetheless internal criticism from organizations that take care of patients. According to Rodrigo Pinheiro, president of the Umbrella Organization for HIV Groups in Brazil, a major difficulty continues to be a lack in supply of medications.
The government still doesn't have a structure that guarantees continuity for the purchasing of medications. There are still problems in the bureaucratic process, and that affects the treatment.
Despite such criticism, activists in Brazil fighting for HIV-positive people and their rights applaud the country's pioneering spirit.
A law guaranteeing free treatment for all people infected with HIV/AIDS has been in place for 15 years now. The guarantee of access to free treatment established in 1996 was the greatest achievement in the 30 years since the epidemic has appeared in Brazil.
For Aguinaldo Gomes, free treatment was critical in gaining control over the disease and for recovering the will to make plans for his future.
I waited 1 week for death to come, then a month, then 3 months. Then I noticed that I was still alive. So I began to really live. And 22 years later, I'm still here.
Laura Schweiger, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Check out our new Destination Europe multimedia project.
For them, their future is to be found in a faraway place, Europe.
When I watch television, I wish I'd be like them.
Our two boats came into Spain. My journey is 4 days. We are 71 peoples.
Actually, education is known as the social vaccine.
Deutsche Welle has met with those on a journey into the unknown. They tell their stories about Destination Europe.
For the next 3 months, you can find a new installment of the Destination Europe project online at dw-world.de/destinationeurope, and you can also hear the radio dramas every Monday on Africa Link. And for our last report today, we take you to Kenya. Nairobi National Park is Kenya's flagship safari park, the first to open in the East African nation. But with the rapid development of the city, most of the park has been fenced off to protect it from the urban sprawl engulfing the capital. Only a 6 kilometer strip remains open to allow wildlife to move freely. But as the land south of this corridor is sold off for illegal farming or residential developments, the park's crucial role as a migration corridor is coming increasingly under threat. Victoria Averill reports from Nairobi.
But see, human settlements, that's a university coming up. Then human settlements. So there was no plan for this house.
Bumping along a dirt track, Julius Kipengetish, head of Kenya's Wildlife Service, scans the savanna horizon in search of the rhino that have made this East African country a world-famous safari destination. It's a damp, grey morning, and it's difficult to make out the skyline of the city that backs right onto the park, just a few kilometres away. As we drop down into a ravine, two lions saunter along the path in front of us.
In addition to being a critical wildlife refuge for Kenya, it's also an entertainment point for people of Nairobi. It's the only place on earth where we have a wildlife refuge right in the middle of the city. So in terms of just being a significant protected area for Kenya, it's also a significant protected area for the world.
But Nairobi is one of the fastest growing cities in the world. It's estimated that its population of 4 million people is growing by 6% a year. Nowhere in Kenya is the conflict between man and animal starker. The pressure for homes, industry and roads is huge. The voice of conservationists, who argue the park is a critical green space and a migratory route for wildlife, is being drowned out by the fanfare of Vision 2030, the plan to develop Nairobi into a 21st century city. The development of land for housing and industry is intrinsic to this plan. The danger is that the land that now serves as a dispersal zone for animals moving out of the unfenced park risks being built upon. In a country prone to corruption, land grabbing and unregulated construction is rife. From her small cottage, nestled on the edge of the escarpment, with views over this sought-over land, Paula Kaumbu, an ecologist who runs the Kenyan Land Conservation Trust, explains how she is working to secure land in the so-called dispersal zone and protect it from the city's voracious appetite for concrete. That means trying to stop land being sold off for construction, or indeed fenced off for farming, so that it remains open for the wildlife to wander freely.
What we're up against, there's political will, obviously. We have speculators and developers who are really keen to make a quick buck, and that's what we're up against. People who really want to acquire land, sit on it, they basically speculate, and then they subdivide it into tiny, tiny plots and then sell them off to make a massive profit.
But to get to the root of the problem, Paula is going straight to the landowners themselves, the Maasai, who have since independence owned the majority of land to the south of Nairobi.
This part of the ecosystem is owned mainly by Maasai pastoralists. There's no reason why people can't live with wildlife. It's actually very possible. The local form of pastoralism is not threatening wildlife at all. And in fact, the Maasai lifestyle is very much in tune with nature.
The Maasai were traditionally nomadic pastoralists. They used to roam these plains freely with their cattle. But as Kenya modernises, the Maasai attitudes to land are changing, and many have decided to sell off their land. It is these small holdings that are posing one of the major threats to the park's dispersal area and clogging up this critical wildlife corridor. In Paula Kaumbu's opinion, the answer to keeping this corridor open isn't for the government to buy the land of these individuals, but to encourage the Maasai to become conservationists. I'm at the Kenya Wildlife Service headquarters, the main entrance to the national park, right under one of the city's busy flight paths. David Sorumbam is a Maasai who owns almost 5,000 acres in the dispersal zone. Instead of dividing up and selling this land, he, along with his Maasai neighbours, is turning it into a conservancy. The incentive? The Land Lease Programme, an idea funded by the World Bank, which gives an annual payout to those Maasai committed to safeguarding their land.
The lease programme is surely helpful. For sure it's working, because it started back in 2000. It started with two families. Now we have more than 242 families, and we have more than 200 other people, the landowners, in the waiting list. These people are bringing their land for conservation. Not everybody in the society believes in land selling. It's only poverty and lack of understanding.
David says that with education, the Maasai no longer see wildlife and the national park as the enemy and a threat to their way of life, but critical partners to securing their livelihoods. But unless the campaign to preserve this critical corridor is put high on the political agenda, time may run out. Julius Kipengetish says in as little as 5 years, the park could be closed.
The worst case scenario is to close the park, and that will be unfortunate. And I would hate to reach there. But that's really the worst case scenario, is if the human settlements around the park, we have no choice but to close it. A big loss for conservation globally, if we are to manage closed systems. And since Nairobi is a very important ecosystem, it will be tragic if we ever close it.
For Deutsche Welle Radio, this is Victoria Averill in Nairobi.
And this report from Kenya wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for joining me today. World in Progress will be back next week at the same time, or anytime you like on the internet at dw.de World in Progress. For today, wishing you all the best from the Bonn studio team, Eliane Giaducci and Gerd Georgi, and from me, Anke Raspa. Goodbye. We'll be right back. You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the programme. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.